welcome to SciGest, your fortnightly serving of digestible science from plant and food research.
Kia ora, ko Nicola Sullivan tēnei. No mai haere mai, and welcome to another SciGest episode. This week we are talking about semiochemicals, or smells, and the valuable role they play in protecting the primary industries of Aotearoa New Zealand from attacks by invading insects. I have the pleasure today of being joined by my colleague Lloyd Stringer, who is an expert in the field of semiochemicals. Lloyd and I work together in the same team within Plant and Food Research at Lincoln, the Chemical Ecology and Behaviour team. Ngā mihi, Lloyd.
Kia ora, Nicola.
Tuatahi, can you start by explaining why detecting insect incursions in Aotearoa New Zealand is important?
It's really around protecting Aotearoa. So I don't know if you recall, about a year or so ago, there was an advertising campaign called Kōtātou. And there it's all around protecting our industries, our taonga, and our people. So when we get a new biosecurity threat coming into the country, we're concerned about, will it affect our people, our native plants and animals, and our industries? For our industries, for example, if we have a new insect that comes in, it may be something that is known to be a very big pest in other countries. So looking at something like Queensland fruit fly, which many people may be familiar with, if we get that established in our country, it's going to be very difficult for us to access overseas markets. So it's definitely something we want to keep out of our country. And of course, there's a lot of other industries as well. So look at the wood industry. It's a massive industry for New Zealand. But again, if we have a new incursion come in that starts killing our pine trees or anything like that, we actually just don't have anything to sell anymore. So instead of losing market access, we just have no market.
It can cost the industries a lot of money, can't it?
Oh yeah, a lot. And that flows on. So you've got your industry itself, but then you've got all the support industries, you know, your trucking industries, you've got all the workers who are working there. All of a sudden they lose jobs. Where are they going to go and what are they going to do?
So lots of reasons why it's important. What are some of the detection systems that we currently have in New Zealand?
Yeah, so we have detection systems for fruit flies. For that system, there are traps set up throughout the country during the summer mainly. And in areas where we have lots of people or imports coming in, we have these traps set up. And they're targeting three types of fruit flies, the ones that go for three types of smells. Those are ones, Q-lure is one smell. It's a smell that's used to attract males to the trap. There's methyl eugenol, that's a smell that comes from a plant. And the males of some different types of fruit flies love to go to and get that smell. And trimedlure, another one that works on things like Mediterranean fruit flies. It's more limited to a smaller number of species.
And we've also got ones for like BMSB, don't we, the brown marmorated stink bug.
So that's a new one that's been knocking at New Zealand's door that there is a surveillance system for now. And that uses another smell, an aggregation pheromone that will bring in all the individuals into an area, and then that area can be sampled. The trap, or by sampling the foliage, just by hitting it with a stick and catching it with something underneath. There's also surveillance for gypsy moths. So that uses a sex pheromone to attract males to a trap. Very powerful, has a very long range, and the males seek this out. And that's the pest we don't want in the country because of all the issues for both wood industries, but also people with these moths, as when our caterpillars have irritating hairs. And then there's a surveillance system for ants as well. Again, that's using smells again to a point, so it uses raw foods and traps, but it's also working on the ants' behavior to recruit, to try and battle and hold that food resource. Again, that's targeting things like red imported fire ant. So that ant there would be an issue for a lot of native species. A lot of industries are going from animals through to horticulture, through to being a general pest or nuisance for people.
Yeah, because they hurt, don't they?
They do.
Stung by them, haven't you?
I have. I did have a little scar for a while, but that was me playing around with them just to see what it felt like.
And that was when you were studying them in America, right?
Yes. So massive issue there in Florida where, you know, you can't really play on your fields outside because you've got all these little mounds and you step on a fire ant nest, you know about it if you stay still. Well, we're fortunate that we are a long way away from other countries and that we have a single border. So it's much easier to manage what's coming into the country and to run surveillance for any threats. It also means we don't have many of the threats coming here naturally.
Yeah, and those detection systems, they're run by the Ministry of Primary Industries, aren't they?
Yes, they are, and industries also run some of their own surveillance systems, but again, with the Ministry for Primary Industries.
And so lots of those, well, all of them really use semiochemicals.
Yeah, that's the primary surveillance tool used. A main reason for that is because these semiochemicals, so these are the smells, or the airborne chemicals, they have quite a long range, so they'll travel for quite a long way away from the trap, whatever you're using to survey with. And then that'll attract the insect and bring the insect to the trap, rather than going in and doing site searches. And that also occurs. So New Zealand will look for pests manually, looking in high-risk areas where goods are coming into the country. They may go and search areas outside looking for various pests that they're known to either hide under logs or in certain areas. So they'll just do a visual inspection. Semiochemicals, much easier because you can put fewer traps out and survey quite a large area. And these chemicals are long-lived. You know, they're not a food bait that will degrade and change. It's a smell that will just keep going until you run out of the chemical. And then they'll run 24/7 as well. So you get quite a long sampling period. So during that whole period of activity when that insect will be searching out that smell, be it one that's linked to food and getting some sort of sustenance, or say for the fruit fly lures, it's the potential for mates.
Yeah, so if we can just sort of define for the audience what semiochemicals are. We've talked about a few different types of semiochemicals, haven't we? We've talked about the chiromones, the sort of the food chemicals, and pheromones, sex pheromones.
Yes, so semiochemicals, they're those conversations that nature's having through smells in the air. And that's like the overarching area. Then within that, you've got the different sorts of smells. So the pheromones are the smells between individuals of the same species. That could be sex pheromones, so males or females attracting each other for mating. It could be aggregation pheromones, that's bringing individuals from both sexes together, primarily for mating again. And then you've got the chiromones, so these are smells between species. So think of a flower's releasing smells that's trying to attract a bee or a fly for pollination. A whole range of odours out there.
Yeah, and when we put out pheromone lures or you know, semiochemical lures, we're talking about very small amounts of nature identical chemicals that we use, aren't we?
Oh, tiny, tiny. If we start with the chiromones or the between species semiochemicals, so quite often it'll be a plant odour, and that smell is put in an area where there's already a bit of that odour out there, so it's competing with the natural sources of those smells. Could be coming from plants, so these tend to have maybe a milliliter type quantities to try and be the biggest smells to attract the insect to that trap. You get to something like sex pheromones though, then we're heading down to nanograms, ants, picograms, femtograms. It's lots of zeros before you get to that decimal point that then goes to a whole number. Tiny amounts, very powerful.
Yeah. So perhaps if we're talking about semiochemicals, can you give us a rough guide to how you create a synthetic pheromone?
This is where I should really grab a chemist. No. The big thing is getting the insect in the first place. So that could be either from having a colony. So that requires, you know, collecting the insect and then rearing it through, which could be a lot of work to get the sort of numbers you need to be able to then start identifying any smells that come from that insect. And we had a case of an insect, grass grub, and we had that, and we were rearing it up and feeding it a diet, and the diet normally has a whole lot of preservatives in there, so the diet doesn't go off, so you don't have to make it every day or anything like that. Turned out though, with this grass grub, it wasn't actually making the sex pheromone. There was a little bacterium that it had a symbiotic relationship with, and that bacterium was creating the pheromone. However, once the insect was reared up on this diet that included things like antibiotics and the like. It also killed off the bacterium. So that one was a real head scratcher, going, how the heck are they finding each other? until we worked out, oh, this is the diet, the issue we have, you know, these antibiotics. But once you have the insect, then ideally you know something about its biology. It's not always the case though, so that can also require quite a bit of study. You know, if someone's sitting there or recording it over 24 hours for multiple days at a time, waiting for it to become sexually mature, and they're looking for those sort of signs that it might be starting to release a pheromone. So quite often it's the female releasing a pheromone, but not always. So you've got to sort of watch both species, but ideally someone's worked on this sort of insect in the past, so you've got an idea of where to target. So for example, if we think of moths, the female tends to do the calling most of the time. And what we'll do then is either we'll try and sample the air or the headspace. Imagine smelling it's like smelling a roast or a beer or something, the headspace, smells good. And you have gear that can take those samples and store them for us to then put into a machine to try and identify what smells are coming off that female. Other ways of doing that is, forgetting that odour, would be to dissect the female. So again, with a moth, when she's starting to call, and they generally call in the evening, you can pull out the pheromone gland and put it into some sort of solvent that will draw out all the compounds that are in that pheromone gland. So once we get to that point, we have a whole lot of compounds in some sort of, you know, in a liquid or in a solid form. We then will try and identify which chemicals are in that mixture. So we put it into a machine called a gas chromatograph. And how that works is that this machine has a very long coil, so around 30 meters long. And inside the column, the compounds are injected through and they run along this column, with smaller compounds generally coming out first. Because they're smaller, they're not getting caught up on the sides of the column as it's running through. And so that way, instead of us getting a whole lot of smells at once at the end, we can start separating out all the different components in there. And at the same time, we can also attach an insect antenna, usually the male, to the end of the machine. So as we're separating out all those smells and we start getting a smell at a time, usually starting with the smallest ones, then getting molecules that are larger and larger and larger that take longer to run through this long column, we can determine what the insects can smell based on sort of wiring up an antenna or a head or even a whole insect and looking for its reaction. And we can do that. Imagine something like an EKG where you've got beep, beep sort of thing going along. So once the insect's wired up, we get a stable sort of line down the bottom, and each time it can smell something, you get this massive spike we can visualize on the screen. And we go, okay, it can smell that smell. We don't know what it means. Could be a repellent, could be, oh, sex, oh, food. No idea, but we know that it can smell that. At the same time, we also have those smells running into another part of the machine called a mass spec or mass spectrometry. And there we're getting a finer detail of what that compound or smell is made of, based on all the ions and all that of the compounds. So once we've identified some smells that give a response by the insect, those are the ones we start to try and identify for what the compound is. So we'll do that with the mass spec, and initially that might start with a library. So we're fortunate that a lot of people have identified odours based on how that compound looks, and that will give us our first indication of what it could be. Now, of course, it's not always right. So we need to generally make that odour or buy the odour if we can, and then test it for that same biological response. We put it through the machine doing the same thing again, seeing do we get that same response by the antenna, and does it still look the same in the mass spec. So once we get there, we go, okay, we've found a whole lot of smells, but again, what's the biological relevance? And that's where it comes down to a whole lot of trials. We may do trials in a wind tunnel. So when I first started at Plant and Food, one of my jobs was to fly painted apple moths in a wind tunnel, just looking for their fitness, and flying the males up to a female. We knew the female was calling and the males they had all the responses of smelling a sex pheromone and searching for the female. So again, with the moth, they'll start walking around like crazy, wing fanning, so flapping their wings very fast, and they'll take off and then fly up towards the female, sort of zigzagging side to side. So they're just trying to identify where that smell is. And when they get the high concentration, they sort of zoom forward and back and forth, back and forth, to make sure they keep in that plume and eventually get to the female. So if we have enough insects, we may do that, where we trial that smell in the wind tunnel and look for any sort of responses of insects flying up or away, just in case it's repellent. But for a lot of the biological risks, it may be a little bit different where we've sampled the insect in a different country or got collaborators to do that for us, identified some of the potential odours that are in the headspace. But of course, if it's a risk organism, we may not even have it in the country, so we can't look at, you know, what are the biologically responsive compounds on the antenna, because we wouldn't have that in the country, and we can't run those trials. So generally that's when we'd start sending a whole lot of compounds back to that country for them to either run trials in a lab or in the field where they have this pest. Once we have that though, you can always refine the odour. So sometimes the sex pheromone or the aggregation pheromone, or the plant odours, it may be a suite of odours that are needed to get that response. So you put out one smell. So you might have hot chips, you know, thinking of people, hot chips, oh, they're good. Oh, hot chips with a bit of some special salts. Oh, it's even better, a bit of sauce or aioli. And it's a bit of the same for the insects. You're going, okay, here's the sex pheromone, but how about this little extra piece? And it may be that little piece, it doesn't seem like much of a, you know, there's a very tiny amount you wouldn't think would have much of a role in the insects finding each other, could have a huge role. So once you put those two compounds together at various ratios, you can improve that lure and attract more of the insects. So when you come into surveillance, you want something that's super sensitive, ideally, so that you don't have to put out many of the lures, because that can be very costly, having a trapper then having to go and check so many traps.
Yeah, so you mentioned the painted apple moth, and that was one of our successful eradication stories from quite a few years ago now, about 15 years ago. Yeah. Can we talk through a brief history of our work on semiochemicals, some of our other successes?
Yeah, yeah. It's scary how quick time flies. I think painted apple moth is sort of over 15 years ago now. In New Zealand, it started around the early 80s. Out of that, we got the desire lure range. That's a bit of a play on words there, desire. So it's around sex pheromones again.
It's all about sex, really, isn't it?
It is. And then DSIR as well, when this first started. Yeah, so what's that? It's 35, 40 years ago now. Mm. New Zealand's been working with pheromones and getting broader into other semiochemicals. And a lot of it came around supporting growers to give them the ability to monitor the population of their pest, their market access pest. And so having these pheromones in the orchard and being able to link counts of insects in a trap to the population pressure, and also when those insects started turning up, allowed the grower then to implement any management strategies they had in place. So back in the 80s and 90s, probably reasonably toxic sprays or longer lasting persistent ones. But through time, through the use of semiochemicals and other tools, managed to reduce the types of pesticide used to become ones that are greener or less persistent and more targeted, so not killing a large variety or range of organisms, and also reducing their overall volumes or the amounts. And because of that, then we've started seeing the rise of ecosystem services, you can say. So this is the natural biological control agents and other predators. Managed to see those come back into these orchards because we've managed to reduce those, the high toxicity sprays.
Yeah, semiochemicals have played a big part in the integrated pest management systems, haven't they?
Oh, definitely, definitely. And changing the chemistries as well. So semiochemicals are a part of that, but there's a whole toolbox of tools that are working together to help reduce any ill effects from some of the tools we use, either on the environment or the people who are using them.
So what are we working on in this area at the moment?
Yeah, so mating disruptions, quite a big area. So that's where we put out a lot of the smell to the point that the individuals can't find each other. So imagine it like a fog. These insects are searching their environment primarily with smell. And once you put a whole lot of that smell out there, it's just turning into this fog and they can't find the females. The females are calling, but the male is deaf or just so overwhelmed he can't find her. And so we have a couple of products, foreplay, again playing on sex, and in this case disrupting the ability of those individuals to find each other and mate and then have further offspring. So that's reducing those populations again. Also working on things like mealybugs. So they're an issue for the wine industry. So they can vector or transport viruses. And so what we're trying to do is give the grower the ability to monitor the mealybug population by using pheromones in traps. So currently the grower has to go out and sort of lift under the bark and look under the canopy and try to do counts that way. And we want to give them a bit more of an objective way to estimate their population pressure or the issue they may have.
Yeah, and that's one that's been released to market this season, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you'd probably know more about that than I, really.
Yeah, it's one I've been working on for a few years now. But it's good to see that to market. And there's another one that's come to market this year on the avocado leaf rollers.
So another foreplay for avocados. That one's targeting some native leaf rollers. So these are moths that we have because these are both market access issues for overseas because they don't have these insects in their countries. And also they create blemishes on the skin of the avocado.
So what about looking into the future? What are we going to be working on down the track?
Good question. I think mammals would probably be the next cab off the rank. In terms of, this is moving away from insects, that is. So you may have heard of predator-free 2050, so where New Zealand is trying to eliminate some predators from the country by 2050. And part of that is improving the effectiveness of the monitoring system. So this will be the lure, bringing the stoats or the possums to the device and also getting them into the trap and killing them. And we think smells are going to play a very big part in that. So females in heat obviously have a distinctive smell that males just go crazy for. And we think we can bring a synthetic version of that into traps. So that'll be another long range type odour, promise of sex. So the males will be really keen to find the females. But it's likely to probably be other cues involved as well. Who knows, there may be sound or something of the female making noise. It's not solely the smell when we get to some of the other organisms. So if we just jump back to the insects for a short bit. So with the night flying moths, you know, they haven't really got many other cues to help them find the female. So they're cued in on those odors. And so if you put out a trap, you'll get those insects into that trap. You've got a day flying insect, then you've got other cues like vision. So there may be a dance between individuals that are sort of looking at how healthy are you? Are you good enough to mate with? And the male and the female can be doing both, you know, they're sort of eyeing each other up going, well, all right, then I'll get closer, and then you got them in the trap. It's probably going to be the same for, say, the mammals. I think the marine's another big space. So again, a lot of odours. These won't be airborne odours. These will be in the marine or the water medium. And again, we don't really know much of what's going on under the surface. You know, it's not like you can sit under there for hours and hours watching fish or crabs or anything. So a few years ago, we worked on trying to identify a sex pheromone for a crab. We started with a crab we already had in the country, but thinking of one that is up in the North Island and slowly making its way further south, displacing some of our native species. And just working in that seawater space where we weren't trying to identify odours, we're using, you know, devices that require electricity and are really conductive, and next thing you want to put them into a seawater or, you know, that sort of environment. It's very harsh, very conductive, makes a heck of a mess of any recordings you're trying to do. But we did get to a space where we could identify when the females are calling, where the smell was coming from, with the idea of maybe eventually having a lure where we could mass trap males. So you're pulling all the males out of the system so the females got no one to mate with and reduce the speed at which they are reproducing that way. And that would, of course, you'd be wanting to flow on and get something for the females as well, so you can trap both out. But yeah, I think marine is a really untapped space for biosecurity, for conservation, you know, just monitoring our fish stocks and so on. There may be a lot of role that odour could play in terms of concentrations of various odours that may be coming from specific species and the like. Yeah, and just back to predator-free 2050, wasps is something that's on the card. So they're sort of a public enemy number one, for us at least. You know, they're also interfering with a lot of native species. So in the beech forest in New Zealand, we have all this honeydew, this sugary liquids coming out of the tree from another insect that's feeding on it. And that's just super juicing up the wasps. They've got all this sugar and they're hyped up and they're going out. Their nests are getting bigger, faster. And of course, they've got to feed them with, you know, you need protein sources or meat sources as well. So they're competing with insects for the sugary and birds for that sugary resource, but then also predating upon a lot of those insects out in our native forests. So we're working on trying to identify a sex room for the wasps so that we can get mass trapping males, for example. So they have a very short window when they're flying and looking for mates, and that could be a window where we could mass trap or lure and kill. So bring them into a device that administers some sort of poison. That's a big target for us. If we are successful, that will be the first Spula sex room unidentified. But yeah, really, imagination is pretty much the limit, I think, for a lot of semiochemical work. And of course, we've got other modes of communication. So sound's a new one that looks quite interesting, or vibrational communication, I should say, globally. And that could be a new area that we get into.
Yeah, lots to do, eh?
Lots to do, yeah. It's very exciting. It's very hard just picking one or two and not getting too distracted.
yeah, absolutely. Well, I think that's all we've got time for, Lloyd. So thanks very much for joining me in this podcast about semiochemicals and highlighting what a valuable tool they are for protecting our primary industries.
Anytime.
And to our listeners, thanks for listening to another SciGest podcast. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe and rate our podcast to let us know how we're doing. You can also email any questions or suggestions to SciGest@plantandfood.co.nz. Until next time, thanks for listening. Mā te wā.